This week's episode has been a long time coming. I reckon I spoke to director Todd Haynes well before Christmas. His latest film, Wonderstruck, received a 3-minute standing ovation at last year's Cannes Film Festival, and I've been desperate to share our chat ever since. Well, the moment has come as Wonderstruck finally gets an official UK release, though you may have already been lucky enough to see it on Amazon. I'm Edith Bowman and you're listening to Soundtracking, a weekly podcast about screen music with some of the biggest names in the business. Based on the best-selling novel by Brian Selznick, who also wrote the screenplay, Wonderstruck intertwines two stories set 50 years apart about children Rose and Ben, both of whom are on quest to find their parents. In a novel twist, Rose's story plays out as a black and white silent movie, which presented various challenges for composer Carter Burwell. More on that shortly, as well as music from Todd's other work, including The Velvet Goldmine, I'm Not There, Carol, and Far From Heaven. But we begin with the background to Wonderstruck, accompanied by extracts from Carter's ephemeral score. Todd, welcome to Soundtracking. Can I start off by saying congratulations on Wonderstruck? It's so beautiful. Kind of welling up thinking about it, to be honest, because it is just like nothing else I've seen.
Thank you. I did feel, when I read the script and then I went back and read Brian's book, I was like, this is absolutely that utterly unique. However it comes out, it'll be something no one's ever seen before. And I thought, I think maybe this could be something that younger audiences could and should have access to.
When you read the book and you read the script, was it very clear to you how you would bring it to life visually?
It was clear that both stories offered a specific but profound wealth of references in the historical periods in which they're set, but also the cinema that's associated with those times. And particularly in the case of the black and white story, where the little girl is obsessed with a silent screen star. So there was just so much about film and the visual language right there. I think the thing that I didn't know, or that was going to be one of the great challenges creatively, was how they would interact, how the intercutting would unfold, how music would distinguish but also join and reflect back upon the other story.
Perfectly in that respect, where, I mean, Carter's done an amazing job on the score on this. It surprises, it comforts, it travels with you. There are so many uses of the score within this film. I imagine the conversations with him must have started quite early on
this. You're absolutely right. And for something like this, it would have needed to. And I wanted Carter to be thinking about it before we started shooting the film. I wanted my sound designer, Leslie Schatz, to be thinking about it before we were shooting. I wanted my sound recordist, who was going to be on set collecting sound, even for the silent part of the film, to be thinking about it and to just collect more stuff than we'd ever think we'd use, just in case it filtered into some strange sound design that was going to be abstract or something, that we could derive sound from other sounds or something. Yeah. And I just wanted the freedom, the palette, to play just at the sonic level. So yeah, we all took that to heart and started to think about it. The most remarkable thing about the score is that I've never made a movie where this was as true. And this was all, so much due to Alfonso Gonsalves, my editor, his genius, is that we realized very quickly that you couldn't even put two of the black and white shots together without music to know how the silent film would work without dialogue. And if it would work. So before we did anything with the picture, we had to score the film with temp music. Imagine how much music we had to pull out of nowhere to just try and go, oh, no, it's not going
to
work.
Did you go back to that era of the silent movies to use that for temp at all?
Or? We did all of it, but I'd say most of the temp music was not. It was more contemporary composers, but who had symphonic element or sort of classical kind of approach, you know? Some of the great scores of the silent era, Prokofiev or whatever, are very specific and very, or the kind of tinkly pianos that gets a little bit.
And the organs.
Yeah, the organs, which we do.
Yeah, which you do.
We do feature in the film.
Yeah, which is wonderful.
In context. The whole film was built on the foundation of a temp track that was almost an hour and a half in length. And then it was like, here, Carter. Go to town, dude. Yeah. It was basically like taking a, you know, four-story house with a foundation and asking somebody to remove the foundation of the house and not disrupt the structure and replace it from scratch, which does happen, which people do in their homes. I actually might have to do that to my house. That's why I bring it up. But it was hard, and it was an enormous amount of work. And I think one of the hardest things about bringing coherent themes to a temp track, which is usually bits and bobs, is only going to be a strengthening element. And it was, to a large degree, but what it sometimes would do was almost overstate things that the temp track was doing with a lighter touch. And that, I think, was the biggest challenge, was to have that much music enter and exit the film that many times throughout the film, when it was appropriate, but not to make you be like, oh my God, here comes another cue.
Yeah.
I can't take it.
Yeah.
And I don't want to hear that theme again.
Yeah.
You know, so that was really what was challenging.
But the different sort of eras that the film's set in, there are obviously different themes around those, but I love how they're not specific to those decades as well, where you play with that, which I think is so important, and it helps that weave between those stories as well, I think.
Right. I mean, there's absolutely moments of lyrical symphonic music.
Yeah.
Never a massive orchestra. It's always sort of in scale to the smaller scale subjects of our story. And then there's places that are interesting with, like, where we used a rag piano that links the two stories, where the kids are on their way to the museum, getting closer to the museum, and it's around the time that Ben first bumps into Jamie.
Yeah.
Thank you. bag piano, which is, of course, Joplin-style piano, absolutely from the 1920s, was also something that became very fashionable in the 1970s after the Sting. And all of a sudden, I think some Joplin was in the top 10 of the charts, the entertainer, because of the Sting. So it was a really funny moment where music from the 20s had a meaning in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. It also had a slightly innocent quality that was right for the characters of these kids. Percussion is another place where I think he has a sensitivity to something that's specific to childhood,
yeah.
A sort of innocence, a lightness, a pleasurable playfulness mm-hmm. that he really foregrounds.
Talked about when they're getting to the museum, but I love that where they're exploring the museum at night with the two of them, Ben and Jamie. And, you know, that's a kind of timeless scene, I think, as well. You know, it could be kids in the 20s, it could be my
sure.
kids now kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Having that dream of being set free in a museum at
yeah.
night, that playfulness of that scene and the music that's within that is really beautiful. It's a really fun scene to watch. I love as well when he walks out into 1970s New York.
Yeah.
It's almost, yeah.
yeah.
It's what a great choice.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah. It's my partner, Brian. He picked the cue from Car Wash, the Norman Whitfield,
yeah.
and the boys run by the fire, the kids playing in the fire
yeah.
hydrant, and that amazing piece of music.
Wow.
That is just not overplayed, not mm-hmm. overly well known, but puts you right there. And it's spare. The arrangement is mm-hmm. so fantastic.
I nearly got up and danced. Out on the street, the summer heat. Boys playing games, changing their names, pulling tricks, getting their kicks. All the way down, let it run. Check it out. Trying everything now. Gotta check it out. Somebody said, you wanna blow? Why not? I ain't got no place to go. Meeting the stars in funky bars. Shiny cars and backdoor locks. Trying to hype for any other type of ride. And choosing music within the narrative was really clever, and I love the, you know, the vinyl and that relationship between music that those characters have of putting something on and listening together sort of thing, and choosing that sweet track as well.
Yeah. I'm trying to give credit where credit is due.
Take the credit, Todd.
That was Brian Selznick's partner, David, who wanted to have the sweet song in there. I love the sweet.
Yeah.
The sweet's in my film Velvet Goldmine.
Yeah.
But that was a really cool moment. And of course, it's also a moment, once again, that reveals intimacy and also deafness. And Jamie puts on the record and then he goes, ugh. And Ben's like, no, it's cool. I can feel it. We remember the turntable that his mother had, where she plays Space Oddity early in the film.
Yeah. Was it easy to get clearance on that track, on the Bowie track?
Finally. After an entire career.
You've been trying.
No to.
Really?
Well, yeah, no. For Velvet Goldmine, I had a lot more Bowie in the script.
Yeah.
I think there were like 7 or 9 songs. And I know the movie is better without it because it was almost too literal, too
reliant
too
on it,
mimetic in a way,
yeah,
and that it gave space for songs that were lesser known, Roxy Music and Brian Eno, and you know, Steve Harley, Cockney Rebel, like stuff that's very little known in the United States, and the opportunity for Tom York to sing the Roxy Music songs in the soundtrack, like, you know, bringing Britpop into play with the 70s era.
Such a sad affair. I've opened up my heart, oh, so many times, but now it's closed.
Spielgeld, Weltraum!
turned to leave. You tried to force a smile as if to compensate. Then you
But still, it was mostly out of a kind of protectiveness on Bowie's part, or maybe, you know, feeling some ambivalence about the script itself.
Yeah.
That was a little sad. I was like, oh, this is my Valentine to David Bowie, and maybe he thinks I'm being too arch or something, or, you know.
I think he would love this. I really do. I think it's worth waiting for in the way that you've used it in this, definitely.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on. 3, 2, check ignition, 1. And may God's love be with you. This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade, and the papers want to know whose shirt you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare. This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door. Stars look very different today. For here am I sitting in a tin can, far above the world. Planet Earth is blue, and there's nothing I can do.
When Rose, grown-up Rose, walks to the bookshop as well, it's a beautiful moment.
Yeah, the Diodato. Yeah.
Really, just...
Again, Brian, I'm not going to steal credits. You can tell.
I'm really generous with you.
I'm quite generous. I so appreciate my partnerships. But that is this jazz funk band, Diodato, mm-hmm. that covered the Richard Strauss... also Sprach für Zarathustra, that's from 2001, yeah. that we all know from 2001. That's kind of a joke on 2001 when it came out in 76 or something. Mm-hmm. And then it was used by Hal Ashby in the movie Being There, when Peter Sellers finally leaves his internment living in the Strand as a gardener. He steps out onto the street of Manhattan and that music plays. We'll be right back. When Brian put it in the script, I thought, is it too many little 70s nudges? And most directors like want to make all the last decisions about source music themselves. They don't want the screenwriter to do it. And, you know, we got to that scene and I was like, we got to try Diodata. And it just felt absolutely earned and delightful. And again, as a film structured like a mystery, it was the turning point. The black and white story had resolved and it just felt like it was, it worked. And then, you know, as a sort of side joke, Space Oddity is a joke on Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
And Diodato is a joke on Space Odyssey from the Richard Strauss, but turning it into a jazz funk version for the true nerds out there.
You mentioned about the screenplay for Velvet Goldmine, and you had Bowie written in his cues within that. When you're writing the film, do you always include music within the screenplay if there's music as part of it?
Yes. When it's something as explicitly about the music as Velvet Goldmine was, about the glam era, and particularly the Bob Dylan film, I'm Not There, where sort of the different genres of his music and periods of his life were channeled into almost these separate vials of character and sensibility played out by these very different characters, seven characters, one of them in a double role. Yes, the music becomes the way the narrative is structured and how it's communicated. Sometimes it's not even my favorite Dylan songs.
Yeah.
I think Ballad of a Thin Man is a great song. Mm-hmm. It's a great song. I mean, there's so many amazing Bob Dylan songs. It's not necessarily my absolutely favorite, but it is absolutely seminal. It is just a narrative piece of his life and story that has to be utilized as a conveyor of a narrative fragment in the film, and it was.
You walk into the room with your pencil in your hand. You see somebody naked and you say, who is that man? You try so hard, but you don't understand just what you will say when you get home. Because something is happening here, but you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones?
It's such a great example of how brilliantly, I imagine that those songs, like you say, they told you the parts of those stories that you wanted to tell almost, you know, through the lyrics or through his presence or, you know, where he was at that time sort of thing.
Very much. They become almost templates. They become like little narrative structures under themselves or little short stories or sequences of scenes or whatever, you know, like little cul-de-sacs of information that reduce down and economize the storytelling process, but in the best way, because it's through music. So it feels completely enjoyable and rhythmic and melodic.
Yeah. Have you got a favorite Dylan song?
That's a hard one, to say
today
one.
Today it would be? I mean, I guess it's like that thing, isn't it, where you have a different one every day, depending on how you feel.
You have a different every day, and then you can't even remember what one it would be today. I'll say Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands. It's just one of the most epic, extraordinary songs. It's maybe too long to play on your show, but you can play some of it.
We can play
some
of it.
It's a whole side of Blonde on Blonde.
With your mercury mouth, in the missionary times, and your eyes like smoke, and your prayers like rhymes, and your silver cross, and your voice like chimes. Oh, who do they think could bury you with your pockets well protected at last, and your streetcar visions which you place on the grass, and your flesh like silk, and your face like glass? Who could they get to carry you? Sad-eyed lady of the lowlands, where the sad-eyed prophet says that no man comes. My warehouse has my Arabian drums. Should I lead them by your gate? Oh, sad-eyed lady, should I wait?
I just still can't believe I made a movie that I got to use it in, as well as every other Dylan song, and that Dylan, differently from Bowie, just said, sure, use it all.
Wow.
Whatever you need.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to make that movie with Sound Alike songs or something like that. Steve Harley couldn't have done it all. How much God loves Steve Harley. But he said yes. You know, maybe anybody would appreciate or be flattered by the idea, although it's absolutely essential to the story of Dylan, to be told in multiple.
Yeah.
To not be reduced down to a single character with a single character arc. In a moment of revelation, oh, that's who I am, and that's why I'm this way, or whatever, which is sort of what the biopic does.
Yeah.
This was like, no, there's six or seven people here, and that's just in the 1960s, and they're all fighting each other, and they're all disagreeing with each other, and they're kind of unwriting each other in succession.
Yeah.
You know, and that describes the complexity of life, how we change, how we differ, and how somebody of that remarkable creative output also survived just the pressure of his success. Because you kind of have to say, I can't fulfill the expectations that I've set up at this moment. I have to betray my following and go in a completely different direction. And then I have creative freedom to invent something new.
The integrity of the man in terms of being true to himself and who he was or is as an artist and wanted to be and the way he wanted to progress for him is why his music's so important.
Endures.
And
I mean, I don't think he would survive without being able to create all the time. And sometimes that took almost a hostility, not just toward what he'd done previously or negation of it, but a hostility toward the intense affixing of expectations that his fan base would sometimes generate.
No, I don't belong to her. I don't belong to anybody. She's my prize for singing angel, but you don't hear me cry.
Talk about Carol for a minute.
Sure.
Oh, gorgeous, gorgeous
Thank
film.
You.
And a brilliant example of a film that has the most exquisite score, again, Carter. but wonderful needle drops and contemporary music that are so important to the story as well, that are part of the narrative, sometimes and sometimes not.
Yeah.
Was that an example of conversations with Carter beforehand and then deciding on those tracks of what would be, were they written in the script?
Once again, except for the Billie Holiday, which is scripted and in the narrative itself.
Yeah.
And I believe is even in Patricia Highsmith's book.
The novel.
I'm pretty sure it is. Other than that, it's a process I usually undergo just for my own sort of psyching up to an era that I'm, a story I'm telling, where I just want to surround myself with the popular music of the time and just have it playing constantly and hearing it constantly and as I'm writing and researching. And I often share these collections with Carter because even if nothing that he's doing in the score is going to directly do an arrangement of a popular song or anything like that, just the kinds of instrumentation that characterize this era versus that can be informative and trigger ideas that are specific. Once again, in Carol, this was Brian O'Keefe, my partner, who has this encyclopedic knowledge of music, and really, he did just this amazing job he put together, and he did this for Wonderstruck, playlist after playlist after playlist. Like, the first 70s playlist for Wonderstruck was about 6 hours long of popular music from the 70s, and it wasn't the obvious stuff.
Yeah.
It was obscure stuff from the 70s.
Yeah.
And from that, in Carol, Fonzie and I, my editor, just picked source music for different scenes. Some of it, because the budget was a lot smaller than Wonderstruck, we couldn't afford. But we did everything we possibly could to get deals and packages and blah, 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 and get them in there. What was nice about the music in Carol, and this is true also in films I made, and I really love to do this, when a song is playing in a source in a scene, like on a record player or on a radio, most people today will just use the digital track and mix it, muffle it down, can it, so it sounds like it's coming out of a small speaker. We literally find a room that's about the size of the room in the scene, play it out of a speaker, and record it with a mic. So it has the natural reverberations and distortions that occur in a room. It's called worldizing.
That's amazing.
And we did it for Mildred Pierce. We did it for Carol. We did it for Wonderstruck. And it's one more thing. My sound designer is as nerdy as I am and meticulous and creative.
Yeah.
And this is something we love to do. And Carter's music editor, Todd Cassow, gets really into this too.
Blink. There. I need lipstick. Again. And you were lucky enough to record his last score with Elmer Bernstein as well, for Far From Heaven. What a wonderful experience to be able to do that.
It was such a wonderful experience because, I mean, that is a bit of movie history and music scoring history that is one of a kind, that's sort of in the, you know, handful of 5 or 10 greatest composers that ever lived. And over his years, Elmer Bernstein composed every conceivable genre of film and yet never really did the melodrama, the domestic drama that he did in Far From Heaven, his last film. He was known for like those cool jazz scores, Man with Golden Arm and Blackboard Jungle from the beginning of his career. And
I think Trading Places is one of my favorites.
He did everything though. But he really did. He did everything. was like a Marxist, a cool New Yorker. And he was like, you know, but remained that same person, that same smart, intellectual, lefty, just a really profoundly inspiring person to know. And we got really close in a really short amount of time at the end of his life. And he had such cynicism for Oscars and Oscar campaigns. Elmer had been nominated countless times for Oscars. Everyone must have thought he had a shelf of Oscars. Mm-hmm. He'd only won an Oscar for additional music to Thoroughly Modern Millie in his career. And he was nominated for Far From Heaven as his last film. He didn't know it would be his last film. And I saw him start to want it again. And to actually have an Oscar party, you know, Oscar member party in Santa Barbara where he lives, just because he loved the movie and he loved the experience and he believed in it. And it was doing better and drawing a wider audience than we would have thought. And then he was winning prizes and then at the Golden Globe Awards and went to Frida, the movie Frida. And then he lost the Oscar. And I have such contempt for the Oscars and for the award season because it tricks you into so caring. Cruel. You know, it just diminishes why we do what we do. It distorts it all. But I just saw it in his eyes, you know, the disappointment.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, it's not fair to make this brilliant artist.
Dangling the carrot.
Exactly.
I feel bad that we have to end on this.
Oh, God.
This slightly negative. But I think that the negative outlook of not winning that is completely outshone by how much people love that film and the people that really matter.
Yeah. No, I feel like my films have had this, maybe especially when they're a little ahead of their time or a little outside of the moment that they actually have a chance and a life that far precedes that moment, you know, and live on, which is great.
Todd, thank you so much
thank
for your time.
You.
It's been such a pleasure.
Likewise,
congratulations on Wonderstruck. Lovely
thank
to
you.
Meet you. Thank
Thanks
you.
So much.
Elmer Bernstein's Oscar-nominated score to Far From Heaven, that's Autumn in Connecticut, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with director Todd Haynes. My huge thanks to Todd for taking the time to talk to us. Wonderstruck has a cinematic release in the UK now and is available on Amazon elsewhere. You can get Carter Burwell's score, meanwhile, via our good friends at Lakeshore Records. Head to edithbowman.com to catch up with all of our previous guests and find links to Spotify playlists of the music featured. And please, if you can, subscribe and rate us on your preferred podcast provider. That's if you get a moment. And you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK too. Next up then, we've been talking about this for the last couple of weeks. We were lucky enough to put on a special screening of Alex Garland's Annihilation. Following the screening, we sat down with Alex and his composers, Jeff Barrow and Ben Salisbury. Next week, you're going to hear the results of that chat. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then. Thank you.